Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm pleased to be joined this week by Charles Derber, who is a professor of sociology at Boston College. He's the author of Moving Beyond Fear, Upending the Security Tales in Capitalism, Fascism, and Democracy. He's done a lot of work recently with Noam Chomsky. He's got a couple books coming out, that's at Chomsky Speaks on the internet. He's written 22 books. This book that we're going to be talking about is his 22nd book, and he's an activist. So thank you for joining the show, Charles.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. Great to talk to you.
And so let's just begin basically, because what is underpinning this work that you have put together, which I think is valuable for assessing the current politics in the United States? What you do is you talk about something called a security story, and you talk about how, or you go into detail with these security stories and how it even goes back to the days of feudalism, where security stories have always been sold to citizens.
That's right. So let me give a little bit of a context for how I move into discussing and why I move into highlighting it at this period in history, because as you say, it's a very ancient story. Capitalist societies have always relied partly on security narratives. The way to understand this and why, you know, I think it's sort of gained even more intensity than historically is that capitalism, think of a capitalist society as a house, and the architecture of that house is an upstairs, downstairs house, like for those of you who have seen Downton Abbey or one of these popular British historical shows where the, you know, the elites, the nobility lives upstairs and the servants and ordinary people live downstairs. It's a good metaphor, sort of architecturally, for how contemporary American capitalism is structured. And the main story that capitalists like to tell to sort of justify the architecture of a house in which, you know, there are people living upstairs in considerable luxury and many, many more people living downstairs in varying ranges of trouble and despair or just struggle. You know, about half the American population gets into severe economic problems if they have a $400 emergency bill to pay, of a health bill or something like that. So, I mean, when capitalism, for example, during the New Deal era from Roosevelt on through the 60s, when the United States economy was growing well and the fruits of it were being distributed a little bit more equally than are today, they used the story of what I call the meritocracy story. They said the reason there's a downstairs and an upstairs and people live upstairs is because society in general benefits when people who are hardworking and have a lot of talent and motivation are able to sort of climb the stairs of the house and move from the downstairs to the upstairs. And there's sort of a natural, the markets in the society more or less guarantee in a good capitalist society, so the story goes, the meritocracy story, that everybody will benefit by giving everybody an opportunity to move up the stairs in the house from the downstairs to the upstairs. And people who are not functioning, you know, effectively and productively upstairs will fall downstairs. Well, the premise of this book is that the meritocracy story, which has long been a leading narrative for sort of getting people in the downstairs to feel trust in the upstairs and sort of belief in the whole architecture of the house, becomes more problematic. It's sort of like a loss of faith in religion. The loss of faith in the house becomes more perilous for the elites in particular when the extremes of life upstairs become so dramatically different than the masses of people in the downstairs. And of course, we've been living over the last 30 or 40 years since the Reagan Revolution in a period when a relatively small number of people are taking almost all the new wealth, and there's a lot of it being created in the society, and it's going upstairs. And more of the people downstairs are in serious trouble. You know, about the famous 1% has about 50% of the income, more of that of the wealth of the whole society, and this trend is accelerating. So it puts people living upstairs, the sort of people who run, who have an enormous amount of money and power, in a state of some anxiety about whether people are going to continue to believe in the house. And we're seeing some of this today with the rise of, been going on for a while, of counter narratives to capitalism. For the first time, I mean, capitalism is still a dominant narrative in America, and people, you know, don't see really clear alternatives. But with the rise of Bernie Sanders and AOC and so forth, you can see that a large number, particularly of young people and Democrats and some independents, are no longer putting a lot of stock in the meritocracy story. This is so then the question becomes for the people on top, living upstairs, how do we continue to get people in the downstairs to believe in the legitimacy of the house and the structure of the economy and the politics of the society? And the argument that I develop in this book is that, well, capitalism, when it gets into trouble of this kind, you know, when people's belief in the fairness or the meritocracy of the system, that story becomes less fervently believed, and many people begin to not believe it. The elites thrash around to try to figure out what to do, and they move back to a story which, as you said as you set this interview up at the beginning, is a very ancient story. It really precedes capitalist societies. It goes way back into ancient times and was certainly very present in feudalism in the Middle Ages, which I call the security story. And the nature of that security story, there are very many varieties of it, and it's not new, but it's gaining, I think, as the meritocracy story recedes in credibility, the elites rely and stoke the security story, which is really a story which says that the reason we need people on top is that they're capable of protecting people. It's sort of a protection narrative, which says that the world is full of dangers and threats. Many of them are traditional national security threats in the United States, like communism, and now the umbrella threat of terrorism or Islamic threats of one kind or another, or immigration. And they're also, and it's just as important, the threats are internal. There are internal enemies of the house who pretend to be good members in good standing, but are actually kind of a fifth column in some way aligned with the foreign enemies, and who are going to take the house down in some way from the inside. So the security story is a story of enemies and fear. And it was very much the classic story in the Middle Ages, where people could not climb up any stairs to a higher. There were the nobility in feudalism, and then there were the serfs, who were basically slaves. And why did the serfs believe in the right of the nobility to rule? Well, there was a very powerful security story, in the Middle Ages, which said that, you know, the world is full of terrible dangers. Satan was everywhere. Religion cultivated this sense of fear. If you read cultural narratives of people in that period, life was always scary and fearful. There were diseases that could kill you all over the place. You might starve. You might, Satan, the devil, could come and get you. And so there were a lot of fears that could be stoked by the elites, the nobility, who were often warriors or priests or, you know, religious leaders, who said to the people, the serfs, we can protect you. And there's kind of a natural, against all these terrible dangers, and there's a kind of a natural, this goes back all the way to Aristotle and ancient times, there's a kind of great chain of being, and it's based on this need for natural, where people at the top have the capability of protecting and offering security to people, the masses of people who really can't protect themselves. And so this is a very ancient and well-tried story. And when it both takes real threats and then invents and manufactures a lot of other enemies who become part of these security narratives. And so I think what we're living through now is, as the meritocracy story has become kind of like the American dream itself, is becoming, people want to believe in it, but finding it harder because it's so hard for people to feel economically hopeful. Many people, you know, who are not well educated or living in the downstairs in various ways, they're looking for some sort of protection as they hear these stories about that. As you think about, say, the way the Republican Party has now turned to immigration, terrorism, and you know. The internal enemies who are aiding and abetting, some of these are immigrants already in the country, some of them are liberal bicoastal elites, liberal professors like me, anybody who is seen as somehow raising challenges to the moral justice of the house architecture, this upstairs downstairs and the security narrative says no, this architecture is actually the only, it's sort of almost a spiritually necessary thing, because one, it offers people the kind of physical and spiritual security that they need to survive. That spiritual element was very strong in the Middle Ages, and it's, you know, in the religious culture of America today, it's very important. And it's also, it's a very racialized narrative in the United States, because remember, I said that the enemies in the security narrative are internal as well as external. In fact, in some ways, more important, because the internal enemy is closer to you, whether it's people of different, you know, religions, or you know, or atheists or secular, or people who are snuck in as illegal immigrants, or people who are simply liberal. Or radically left and therefore seen as challenging the basic way of life of America. You know, people who are globalists, as they're called today, and are challenging the national identity of the country. So that's what the book is basically doing, is trying to show how the elites living upstairs in a period of growing inequality and declining belief in the American dream, sort of have spun out a more intense version, a contemporary version of a very ancient security tale or security narrative, and it's very obvious in the case of Trump, but it long precedes Trump. It's been a central story for both the Republican and Democratic parties certainly for a long period, and accelerated intensely during the Reagan Revolution, as globalization and economic inequality began to get very intense. And Reagan talked about the evil empire and the necessity of building up the military even more. And the Reagan Revolution was really, in some ways, both a neoliberal economic revolution and a sort of revolution of culture and security narratives, dominant stories about the society, which have evolved into Trumpism today, and really reflects the extreme, development of a very old story told in a slightly new way.
So, as you say, it's really obvious what Trump is doing. You can see it's apparent because he names them. He's not ashamed to point fingers at these so-called conjured enemies. You know, he points to the undocumented immigrants. He points at the American Muslim community. He's pointing at Black Americans. He's also labeling the threat from globalists, as you even mentioned. But it's a little less clear when you look at Democrats. It's much more subtle. But in the same way, though, it's a security story. And I'd like to put this to you, because it was real for people who are listening. I was inspired by your book, and it helped solidify a lot of my understanding of some of the events of the last 2 to 3 years with the Democratic Party, particularly with regard to the fracture that the Democratic Party establishment has had to deal with among their base as a result of the popularity of Senator Bernie Sanders and his presidential campaign, which really has forced conversations around issues like single-payer health care, jobs, free college tuition, taxing the rich, environmental justice, and rolling back corporate welfare. And so I think in response to me, when I'm going through your book, I started thinking, well, they needed a security story that they could deploy that would help them manage these irreconcilable differences that were being developed. And so what did they do? Well, if you looked at Nancy Pelosi, or if you looked at Chuck Schumer, who have both been leaders in Congress, or if you looked at the Democratic National Committee chair, Tom Perez, they needed to cast Trump as a tyrannical figure. But that wasn't enough to just talk about domestically the threat that he posed. They had to cast him as somebody who was under the influence of a foreign power. And they've made claims that insinuate or outright state that they believe he's working for Russian President Vladimir Putin, or that he's naively going along with Vladimir Putin's agenda. And to me, it seems like this is a really effective way to manage the division in their party. And since we're recording this on April 19th, and we just had the release of the Mueller report, which is a culmination of an investigation that has occupied so much attention for Democrats under Donald Trump's administration, I'd like you to talk about Democrats and their use of security stories.
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised this, Kevin, because it's really important to understand that the Democrats are, you know, the United States is distinctive as a developed society because it really doesn't have a labor party or a party that's in some way trying to move beyond the architecture of a quite radically divided upstairs, downstairs kind of house. And so the Democrats have been historically, certainly in the last 50 years, since the New Deal has been basically eroded, but one could argue much longer, it's always been a proponent partly of the meritocracy story because it's embraced capitalist societies, the Democratic Party. And when meritocracy is challenged, the Democratic Party, and when capitalism becomes problematic, I mean, for mass millions of workers, as it has, the Democratic Party also, like the Republican Party, relies very heavily on the security narrative for maintaining its own legitimacy. In other words, one way to think about this issue, what you're seeing now with this enormous focus of both the Democratic leadership, the Pelosi's of the Democratic Party and Schumer's, along with the Republican Party. This is, as you say, this is not, Trump is sort of most nakedly pushing fear of enemies and manufacturing all kinds of terrible enemies. But that's, in a way, disguising the point you're making, which is that the security narrative has now become so entrenched in the mainstream political discourse that both Democrats and Republicans rely on it as a way of maintaining their own legitimacy as a party. So the first thing I would say is just that the Democrats are equally engaged with the Republican that is the mainstream Democratic leadership, particularly in sort of perpetuating a story of the threats, the security threats that require a national security apparatus, whether it's the CIA, the FBI, the U.S. military, and all of the internal enemies that might be allied with, Muslims or socialists abroad and so forth. So I think what we've seen over the last couple of years of the Trump administration is the Democratic Party feeling that if it's going to challenge Trump and the Republicans, it has to do so. The most effective way to do so is to sort of buy into the security narrative even more intensely than the Republicans. In other words, to put Republicans on the defensive by arguing that they're actually selling the country out to the very threats that traditionally that Republicans have highlighted, and you've gotten this sort of remarkable shift, not in the security story, but in the ways in which now, in order to sort of go after Trump, the Democrats argue the problem with him is that he's undermining the security of the country by essentially becoming an agent of, you know, the evil empire, as now sort of the authoritarian Russian enemy, and that he is manipulating and weakening the so-called deep state powers are really the instruments of security for the country that the Republicans have always championed. You know, the FBI, the CIA, the National Intelligence Services generally, and the military in all its form, and the police. These are all instruments of national security, and they've always been things that Republicans have been seen as championing, you know, most fully. But the truth is that the Democrats have always embraced this, and if they are going to try to, you know, sort of take Trump down, they feel the only way they can do that is by arguing, well, he's the one that's actually undermining what, you know, you Americans should expect from their leadership, from their people living in the upstairs, and that is to protect them and to protect the integrity of the national security state. And so on the one hand, they're highlighting and sort of rekindling the new Cold War. So they're building up Russia as this overwhelming enemy. It's worth noting that Russia, by the way, two things about this sort of Mueller, since we're in the Mueller period right now, the Mueller focus on Russia. I mean, one is Russia is economically to get about the size of GDP of Italy and France together. It's not a major power economically. It has a lot of nuclear weapons, but once you have more than about a few hundred nuclear weapons, you're basically kicking the rubble around. So this buildup of Russia is really an effort to reconstruct the new Cold War, and an argument that Trump is dangerous because he's undermining the understanding of how dangerous Russia is today. Now, Russia, I believe that Russia attempted to manipulate, to affect the American elections. But this kind of, intervention, the United States has been engaging in intervention in elections around the world, you know, for years and years. And, you know, many other countries do all kinds of things that involve trying to shape the outcomes of elections in other countries. The United States in much more blatant ways by taking out leaders or whether you think about Iran or, you know, back in the days of putting in the Shah or Guatemala and the Central America, the U.S. is constantly involved or through hacking today and so forth. The United States is very active in the things that they are accusing Russia. So I'm no lover of Russian authoritarianism, but Russia has been turned into a security threat way beyond what it actually constitutes, in my judgment. And the Democrats are doing this because they've bought into the security narrative as the only way to achieve political legitimacy for their party. And so I think, and the same thing with, you know, with immigration and with terrorism, you know, Obama built up the military, you know, particularly against, quote, terrorist targets in Africa, where Obama built many more military bases. Obama did a great deal more to deport immigrants, actually, than Trump has in terms of actual numbers of people being deported. So that your point is very important, and it kind of goes to the point of my book about Moving Beyond Fear, about how central this has become to the culture. If you challenge these constructed enemies and these threats around which the entire structure of the society sort of comes together, the Democrats have, you know, essentially felt that they the only way that they can gain political you know, popularity and legitimacy is by showing that the Republicans are actually abandoning the security of the country, and that Trump now, but the Republicans more broadly, are being viewed as somehow undermining the very institutions, the deep, quote, what they're calling the deep state institutions. They're undermining those, you know, the FBI, the CIA, all the branches of the military and so forth. They're saying the Republicans have now become a source of scary threat because they're weakening the institutions that are the bulwark of national security in the United States. So it's a very strange political flip where the Democrats are going after an authoritarian right-wing populist on the grounds that they're not protecting the security of the country. And at the same time, the right-wing populists have gained power by highlighting ever more intensely how dangerous the world is. So, but I think the primary thing is to suggest, and I think it's at the heart of your story, that it's very hard to, whether you're liberal or conservative or Democrat or, you know, and you see this in the fear of Democrats more broadly to challenge American foreign policy and the sort of imperial policy of the United States, which has always been built, the sort of militarism of the United States, and it's sort of, whether it's the war in Iraq or the wars in Central America or the war, you know, that is sort of building up now with Iran. These are central to the discourse of the country, and the Democrats historically have been as deeply engaged with this as the Republicans have. And that's a reflection, again, of if you step back and sort of take the view from the top, you look down at the American House, and the Democrats and the Republican Party are both speaking for different parts of the elites on the top. Now, the Democrats actually carry a softer voice. They do. You're beginning to see among more progressive sectors like Bernie Sanders and so forth, the beginning of a challenge to that architecture and saying that, well, real security probably rests in redefining this architecture and redistributing wages and benefits and education and healthcare down further in the House. But, you know, Sanders has been slow to challenge the security narratives. He's just beginning to talk more about that. And the Democrats in general are very hesitant to do so because that security narrative has become so deeply entrenched. It's basically identified with being American. If you challenge the security narrative and the sort of an idea that America is a country under threat, it's the beacon of the world, and American functions in the world as, you know, as a protector of liberty and freedom around the world. Anybody who challenges that narrative is going to be politically weakened. And when we were talking before the show, Kevin, you mentioned you had spent a lot of your early time reporting on Chelsea Manning. And there's an example of how much most Democrats as well as Republicans have gone after Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange and other whistleblowers because they feel obliged or they've bought into this idea that anybody who is whistleblowing about the crimes of American imperialism and expansion, and which are, of course, innate parts of American globalized capitalism, because they're necessary for profit in a globalized economic system. All of these things, the Democratic Party are going to, you know, they're not willing to stand up for these whistleblowers, and because they're seen as in some way undermining the security narrative that's central to the sort of religion of the country, the political religion of the country. So it's a very, very serious problem because both political parties are very locked into these security narratives as the only way that you can maintain the legitimacy of the economic system and the popular support of the country.
So as a follow-up, I'd like to ask you about the particular aspect here that I believe and what you think, which is that there's a utility to this security story in the sense that it can maintain the status quo in capitalism. And that's particularly what the Democrats need, because they don't want to have to provide the kind of reforms that are being demanded, the kind of policy changes that the base is demanded, because it fundamentally requires them to change their relationship to the capitalist system. And then likewise, it puts them in a position where they have to defend certain politics that they don't even subscribe to when they're attacked by President Donald Trump. And something that you could not have predicted would happen when you, or well, you probably could have imagined it was possible, but you didn't know it was going to specifically erupt when you were writing your book, is what's happened in Venezuela with the escalation, the very dramatic escalation of imposed sanctions. And something that I fundamentally believe in, and for people who listen to our show, we've talked about this in previous episodes, is that Donald Trump is actually using Venezuela as a kind of cudgel in order to attack the kind of working class politics and progressive agenda that people who support Bernie Sanders are trying to fight for in the U.S. In other words, he's claiming, and this is a security story in a way, that Venezuela has destroyed its society by adopting so-called socialism. And so if you want to become Venezuela, you can vote for Bernie Sanders. If you don't want to become Venezuela, you can vote for me.
Yeah. No, that's very well put, Kevin. Your premise that the Democratic leadership, the party as a whole, is not prepared to meet the real needs and demands of the base. And therefore, they since they're not really prepared to offer what I call true security, the last parts of the book are about what a new kind of security story that really speaks to the needs of people downstairs would look like. And they're not prepared to go there. They need to rely, particularly the leadership of the party, on their own brand of the security story. And I want to come to Venezuela, but just let me briefly say, it's very widely, when on MSNBC and other liberal democratic outlets, you see this all the time, for example, and in the Democratic Party and Democratic Congress. For example, thank you for your service. Democrats have to say that to soldiers as much as Republicans do. Lionizing John McCain. Well, John McCain was no doubt a courageous soldier, but he was involved in a genocidal war in Vietnam. I spent my early days fighting. And he was killing, bombing thousands of people in Vietnam and killing them. And yet he had to be seen as a war hero. John Kerry, when he ran, could have run as a, you might say, a peace hero, but he ran as a war hero. We don't really have the vocabulary of a peace hero, because the security narrative is so deeply entrenched that peace is kind of un-American in that sense. I mean, it can only be resting on war and the kinds of challenges to enemies abroad and at home. So the whole discourse has been organized around the security narrative, and it shapes the visceral everyday instincts of how you talk about particular wars, what America is doing overseas. So what you said about Venezuela is really insightful, I think, that, by demonizing, the Maduro and the sort of more progressive movements of the poor in Venezuela, which is a society that's been destroyed by American, policy and intervention for quite a long time. But what Trump is doing, and it's not new at all. It's something that the U.S. has been doing toward progressive politics in Latin America and Central America. You see all this also at the same time with Brazil, where one of the most progressive leaders, Lula, the president of Brazil since the early 2000s, was basically taken down. I know this because my friend Noam Chomsky was in Brazil and went to prison when Lula was in prison a few months ago, and when Bolsonaro was essentially put back into power through American intervention. But the basic dynamic of it was very similar to what you described, it seems to me, that by sort of highlighting Lula or the Maduro and the Venezuelans as the ultimate enemy. They're linking the democratic socialists who have begun to emerge to begin to speak to some of the real crises that we're experiencing in American capitalism. They're saying, well, if you go that route, you're going to become the evil out there. It used to be called, you know, the evil empire of the Soviet Union. Now it's the socialist policies of a Maduro government in Venezuela, or of the Workers' Party in Brazil, or any number of other, you know, regimes, many of which have significant problems, but which are being very easily reframed around the security narrative to say, look, the real crisis Americans are facing is that you have these, you know, authoritarian, terrible threats that people like Maduro and Lula represent, and the Democratic Party, or at least the Democratic Progressives, are simply the fifth column inside that's going to turn America into exactly that kind of scary society that's going to take away your freedom and is going to become a big government society which is going to imprison you and really get you to fall all the way to the bottom of the house. So, yeah, I mean, the Democrats have been very unwilling to challenge American interventionism, which is in the name of liberating these countries from tyranny, socialist, big government, and so forth. But they've been trapped because by buying into the demonization of these societies, they're allowing the Republicans to sort of identify them and their policies with, you know, things that ordinary Americans have learned to think of as things that are going to take away their freedom by imposing big government on them. And of course, the reality, the truth is that the real security that the United States needs, the people downstairs need, does involve a much more significant role for government. But it's not the kind of big government that Americans have learned to fear. Let me give you an example. For example, if you look at Germany or Denmark or Sweden, which are at least steps in the direction of what I would call more genuine security for the population, you have all kinds of national programs which international human rights, which are protected by the government to education and healthcare and so forth. But you don't actually have big government. The government collects taxes to pay for, say, universal healthcare or universal, college education is free in Denmark and many other Scandinavian countries, which are, you know, the Viking model, as George Lakoff said, of economics, sort of. But, you know, these countries don't actually have huge governments. Germany has a much smaller federal government than the United States because when taxes are collected to pay for, say, universal health care or free college education or job training and job creation, it's being administered through provincial governments, unions, local governments, and so forth. In other words, power is being redistributed away from the state, the national state, in towards certain kinds of global institutions, in the EU, for example, which can help to redistribute resources. And also, much more important, the redistribution of power inside the country toward labor groups, labor parties, and local and regional and other civil society sorts of organizations that administer these things. So, you know, the security narrative turns these progressive social security agendas into a big government, take away your freedom fear. So it's another way of fighting off what the people in the house, really, the people downstairs who have real needs and have real grievances. They need these kinds of security programs, but the kind they need is being demonized in a way that Republicans have always done so. And now the Democrats have always essentially being unwilling to really challenge that and to really offer people, because Democrats, like the Republicans, depend on wealthy donor classes to stay in power, the people upstairs. They then also cling on to the security narratives and they realize that what they've done over the years has so entrenched this this discourse about enemies and the need to have a militarized imperial country, which is constantly on guard against threats, both from enemies outside and inside. I want to say one other thing, if I could, just very quickly. The enemies outside are fairly obvious, you know, whether they're immigrants coming up against, and you have a wall to protect against them, so to speak, that Trump talks about, or they were communists or terrorists. But it's really important, and you see this whole dynamic of security narratives happened in Germany, in Weimar Germany, and prior to Hitler coming in, where you had an extreme economic depression after World War I in the Weimar Republic in the 20s in Germany. And the right wing, people like Hitler, used the security narrative very effectively, and it was partly against foreign enemies who had imposed very strong, you know, retribution against the Germans after World War I. But most of it was directed to purge the internal enemies, who were the Jews and the Slavs and other non-Aryan groups, so a racialized internal enemy that would be exterminated. And so the this narrative is really broadly used across the United States and both parties, and there's a long historical scary narrative around it, and the Democrats have not been courageous enough to challenge the fundamentals of this. Now, it's going to be very interesting in 2020 whether, as you said, the anti-Trump politics of liberals and the Democratic Party and the liberal media like CNN or MSNBC and the mainstream Democratic Party, they're in some ways intensifying the security thing. They're saying, vote for me because, unlike the Republicans, we really value the CIA and the FBI and, you know, the adults in the room, you know, they're Jim Mattis, or there was the, you know, the first Secretary of Defense under Trump. The adults in the room were the people who took us into Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. And so the Democrats, in their zealotry to sort of win back the White House, have done it what they think is the easiest way, which is to argue that the reason to vote against Trump is that he's undermining the security of the country. And so you see how powerful this security narrative has become. It's become the national religion. National security is the national religion, and it's become the dominant political discourse. And as the meritocracy story, as the economy continues to get more polarized and more people, essentially are in relative despair over their economic situation. The beautiful economic picture that both parties seem to be sort of talking about is very misguided, because while there's been a certain amount of growth, it has been so maldistributed, and, you know, so much of the wealth is being absorbed at the very top, and so little of the wealth has ever trickled down or been redistributed to the people who really need it. And so Americans in a, quote, you know, growth economy are more in trouble. Like I said, about 50-60% of Americans are working multiple jobs. They're trading off. They're feeling very anxious about their economic situation. That's going to simply intensify the security story until the Democrats or, you know, some political movement dynamic is able to challenge the entire foundations of the security story. Remember, the security story rests ultimately on a kind of global capitalism, which requires, the big banks in Wall Street and the big companies in America absolutely depend on global markets and increasingly will do so. And they need the military and the security apparatus to secure the world, all over the world, to make it favorable for American corporate profits and interests, and they need the resources. So as globalism intensifies, ironically, under the rhetoric of nationalism, and it's very important to realize that globalism, nationalism, hyper-nationalism of the kind Trump talks about, make America great again, is really a kind of globalized nationalism. The policy is highly globalized. Trump's business was, you know, he was bringing in workers all the time who were, you know, at his country clubs and so forth. But he uses the rhetoric of nationalism as a way of heightening the power of the security narrative. Said, yeah, America, the House, is under great attack by all these global elites and global forces. But of course, he's an architect of global capitalism. And so anyway, the importance is that we find a progressive movement in this country that's bold enough to challenge this security narrative, to realize that the reason to challenge Trump is not simply because Russia has become a new, even more intense enemy or something like that, and that because he's, you know, the Democrat, that he's weakening the FBI or the CIA. If you watch Rachel Maddow, who's a smart person, you'd think the main reason to vote against Trump is that he's undermining the CIA and the FBI and so forth. You know, he's undermining the social well-being and the economic well-being of most of the country, and he's doing that by poisoning the well of American, racial and, diversity of religion and so forth, and going toward a kind of hyper-white nationalism, which is does have a lot of, I mean, I've done a lot of writing and thinking about what happened in Weimar Germany. Weimar was the Germany in the 20s when the right wing, the far right, became highly nationalistic in Germany and turned against and became a very racialized politics. And I think you do see a very comparable development in the United States. And the progressives in Germany were not able to contest that, even though there was a much more serious left in Germany at that point than there is in the United States today. And it just speaks to the need of grassroots movements. I spent a lot of my time in grassroots movements. And, you know, we are, despite all the conservatism in the country, the U.S. has, you know, as anybody who's read Howard Zinn, we know we have been a country of that's been friendly to, you know, the abolitionist movement, the women's movements, the labor movement. They played important roles in U.S. politics, despite all this security discourse. And so I do believe that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party ought to have more courage and speak to build its relationships with these movements, which really do speak for a very large section of the population. When you should look at public opinion polls, most people want Medicare for all. Most people want they like labor unions. They like cooperatives and worker-owned companies. 70% of the population. They increasingly, if you just ask people their emotional response to the word capitalism or socialism, Gallup poll has been doing a series of these polls over the last 5 to 10 years, and within significant parts of the population, socialism has a more emotional positive affect, according to people who are asked, than capitalism does. And on all sorts of issues that somebody like AOC or Sanders or Warren or other progressive Democrats are trying to say, the Democratic base is surprisingly resonant to this. So I think there are opportunities here, but whether the Democrats are going to be able to crash through the overwhelming constraining powers of the security narrative so that they can move to really addressing the real social and economic security of the country and the people, the masses of people, is the real question. I wrote the book because I feel like there's an opportunity here, and the Democrats and the movements have to move very urgently to address these issues. And we haven't even talked about, you know, the climate change issue, which is at the core of much of the crisis of modern capitalism, and the war crises that and how deeply the security of the country requires massively reducing military expenditure and redirecting and taxing these people who are living on the upper floors and taking that vast amount of money that is in international, you know, financial speculation and so forth and turning it into real security, the real needs of the population, rather than into the security narrative enemies, which are just absorbing all the money that can save the planet.
Well, we've gone a bit longer than I had intended, but that's fairly typical for this show, as listeners will recognize. They usually hear me say we're going to be wrapping, and then it takes like 20 minutes or 30 minutes before we get to that, just because there's so much to tackle. So but I do want to give you an opportunity to provide some closing thoughts, and I'm just going to throw a couple things your way that you could choose to react to. I mean, first of all, as you say, climate change, there's an issue, and you make this point in your book that there are real security threats that the people who run this country, who are in power, whether you're looking at the Republicans or the Democrats, they do not either adequately address those security threats, or if you're talking about Trump, you deny, you pretend that they're not real, so that you don't have to do anything at all. And I also say to you, I think I feel, as we've explored this issue through our show, and as I've followed it, that, and as I stick with where our conversation has led, possibly not addressing that threat meaningfully is because you'd have to fundamentally change the nature of American capitalism and American imperialism in order to truly address the threat of climate disruption that is wrecking parts of the global South and other parts of the world. The second thing I want to throw out, and I just want to read this to people, because you talked about this house when we started our conversation, and you picked the parts of the upstairs and downstairs, but I think this is something that people who listen would be interesting to hear, and you don't have to go on and on about this, but I did want to mention to people that part of your book deals with a professional managerial class, which you say is on the mezzanine, closer to the upstairs than the downstairs, inhabited by the generally well-off and culturally authoritative. And this group of highly educated doctors, lawyers, professors, journalists, and other professional or managerial employees numbering perhaps 10% of the population, dubbed the new class by the sociologist Alvin Gouldner. It has more wealth than the top 0.1% and the entire downstairs combined. If in 2016 you were a typical working person in the bottom 90% in wealth, you would have to increase that wealth 12-fold, good luck with that, to leapfrog onto the PMC mezzanine. And you make some points about this class, but one of the things that's important is you talk about this professional managerial class and how they sort of have this, they play this dual role where they can tell the working class what to think, and it empathizes with what they're going through, but then in other ways they can reinforce what power is doing through their security stories.
Yeah. Well, these are both really important points, Kevin. And I think that, you know, like this new class, they're on the mezzanine, the professional class, they're seen as part of the internal enemy in some ways by the elites, because they're often quite liberal and democratic. But they've also helped move the Democratic Party away from a critique of our broad economic system, you know, the way the American capitalism system works, because they're benefiting from it. And so the left has become, in my judgment, too much of an identity politics kind of movement, meaning looking at siloed race and gender politics, which are very important, but can't really create the kind of transformation that we need unless they're, you know, these are they need to be movements that recognize the intertwining of racial, class, and gender politics. And since the end of the late 60s, the politics on the left has become more siloed and more of an identity politics, abstracted away from these issues of the house, the upstairs and the downstairs. So I think they have to be reintegrated into that house. And then the mezzanine professional class has to take responsibility for talking about that. And Bernie Sanders and some of these other progressive Democrats do represent that mezzanine class. And I hope they will help sort of light a fire under this class to begin to think about its relation to working people and to the larger working class that is not doing nearly as well as it is and needs a great deal more economic transformation. I wanted to end just saying the climate, the first point you mentioned, the climate and war thing, this is also a kind of intertwined set of threats. Capitalism, climate change, and militarism are intertwined in their DNA. And that's the real heart of the real security problems of the country. And we won't survive as a species. We're already sort of in a process of extinction every day as we're talking. You know, life species are going extinct, and genocidal wars are destroying whole indigenous populations and so forth. So this is no joke, and there's not a lot of time to change these things. So that we're fighting, we have really profound security. It's ironic that we have these really unprecedented security crises, which are of a very different nature. The security apparatus that we have and the security discourse we have is ironically making us profoundly more insecure, because it's diverting our attention and diverting our money and our efforts to a militarized, society, which is using police and military and foreign intelligence to fight these manufactured enemies to a large degree, while we have the most urgent need I think humans have ever experienced in any part of human history to direct their attention and their resources and so forth to these existential crises of climate change and of nuclear war and so forth. And that can be done only by massive economic changes in the House, where when you have a tiny number of people who happen to be executives of the oil companies or in the military companies or in the banks, when those small numbers of people in their corporations or banks are sort of directing the allocation of money and political initiative in the country, in the name of security, fighting foreign wars, fighting to maintain safety in the country from these so-called enemies, we're profoundly undermining the security of all humanity, not to mention just Americans. And so this is now a desperate situation. I really believe in no time in history has this kind of crisis faced humanity. And so it's really urgent that people, sort of find a way. And I think, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has to be courageous enough to really push this very, very hard. The Green New Deal is one short, small step in this direction of really moving towards saying we've got to, get rid of this set of enemies that the military has been set up to fight and so forth, and all these other false enemies, and redirect all our resources out of the military budget, out of our, quote, national security budgets, into the real issues of climate, green infrastructure, jobs that will, and public goods generally, medical care, education, that will support an overwhelming new kind of society that can address the real profound security issues of our time. So, yeah, it's ironic that a society addicted to security narratives is addicted to the narratives that are making us more insecure than at any point in any society in history. And we ought to recognize that contradiction and redirect our efforts toward dealing with the real social economic crises of the country.
Thank you, Charles, for taking time to talk with us. I want to tell everyone who's listening that they can get a copy of your book, which I have to be clear here. We are only talking so far in our conversation about a small segment of what is in your book. There's so much outlined and laid out here that people can dig into, and it's supremely relevant to everything that's happening around us as far as domestic politics and international politics. So you can go to Routledge.com. Routledge.com, and the publisher actually makes it easy for you to get it in paperback or to have an ebook, it's pretty fairly priced, I'd say, and you get free standard shipping if you would like the book. So, Charles, again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Kevin. I enjoyed the conversation with you. Appreciated the opportunity.
Once again, thank you for all of your support. We could not do this show without the 210 plus patrons who give to us on a monthly basis. If you happen to stumble upon this show and hear the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast for the first time, let me take a moment to encourage you to become a patron today. You can go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure, patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure. You can give at any level, and just by becoming a patron, you'll open up access to exclusive content, We have a special episode, a reward episode that's in the works. It should be out in May. It's going to be special for patrons only. It's going to be on the state of the media between Rania, myself, and some special guests. So you'll want to be a patron for that show. The only way you'll be able to hear this show is by being a patron. So if you'd like to become a patron of our show, go to patreon.com/onalltherisedisclosure. Thank you.